And do you have a comment, a criticism, a suggestion? Throw in some faint praise and then email it all to bigpicturescience@seti.org.
But reason was the driving force of the Enlightenment. And, oh, blast, it's that woman with the empty peanut shells again.
WHFR Dearborn.
This is Ari Hess. You are listening to WHFR Dearborn.
The following is a pre-recorded program and does not reflect the views of WHFR, Henry Ford College, staff, or members. This is Betty Daniels, and I want to welcome to Impact. And in the studio, we have Mr. N. Charles Anderson. Okay. And Mr. Anderson, would you introduce yourself to our audience and let them know who you are and what you're about?
Sure, sure. I'm really pleased to be here, Mr. Daniels. I'm, of course, like you said, N. Charles Anderson. The most common question people ask me is, what does the N stand for? But it actually stands for Nicholas. It's not a name I dislike. It's just as a young boy, I thought my real first name was Charles, not Nicholas. So I just kind of went by N. Charles.
Oh.
Yeah, so, you know, that's it. But I'm you know, president and CEO of the Urban League of Detroit in southeastern Michigan. We used to be known just simply as the Detroit Urban League, but as we were 101 years ago. But a few years ago, we changed it to extend ourselves because we cover parts of Oakland as well as Macomb County. And so we're the Urban League of Detroit in southeastern Michigan, a position I've held twice in my career.
All right. Concurrent, back-to-back, or different?
Well, you know, I came to the Urban League originally in 1987, from actually being on the national staff of the NAACP. I worked for Dr. Benjamin Hooks and covered the Midwest region. But when I joined the Urban League in October of 87, I served until 94, mm-hmm. January 94. Dennis Archer became mayor of Detroit. He convinced me I should work in city government. So I actually left the Urban League in 94 and worked for Mayor Archer. I ran a city department for Archer, the Department of Human Services, the old Neighborhood Services Department. I did that for about 3 years, and then the Urban League asked if I would consider coming back. They had hired someone to replace me, but that person left after 18 months. And, you know, a government appointment only lasts so long. So I decided to come back. So I'm actually in the 101-year history of the Detroit Urban League, or the Urban League of Detroit.
All right.
I am the sixth and the eighth president in his 101-year history.
All right, I have a question for you, because mm-hmm. as I was telling you about the research, it was enormous. There's the National Urban League.
Yes.
All right, and then there's the affiliates. Are you called affiliates?
We call it affiliates.
All right, okay. The mandates or the mm-hmm. mission statements, are they the same or are they distinctive? But before we do that, because in your introduction, you indicated about the NAACP mm-hmm, at mm-hmm. another organization, and then those are two organizations that have similar. Mm-hmm. You're both working for the community,
but
you may have different missions. So let's kind of backtrack.
Sure.
For the Detroit affiliate, mm-hmm. okay, can you give us a background and history of it?
Sure. You know, and since I worked for both organizations, I often try to give a little tidbit about the differences between the two organizations, because the Urban League. The NAACP was originally founded nationally in 1909.
Okay.
And its primary purpose was to deal with racism, the Ku Klux Klan, discrimination, the lynching, the issues that African Americans were facing in the Southern community. And in 1910, the Urban League was founded nationally. And its mm-hmm. primary purpose was to deal with the social service needs of African Americans. Its original placement would have been more northern cities.
All right.
So, you know, there were a large number of African Americans who were leaving the South, leaving right. Mississippi, leaving North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, trying to escape the oppressive conditions in the South. And they thought it was a little bit better up north. So as people arrived in places like Detroit or Chicago or St. Louis or Philadelphia, New York, there were a great needs for social services And so the Urban League came into existence to provide the for the needs of African-Americans who were moving to these communities. Mm-hmm. And so that's how you got the Urban League in Detroit in 1916. The Detroit Urban League came into existence to deal with that big influx of African-Americans coming. There were a large number of people who were social workers who came to work for the Urban League,
right,
and helped work to get people situated and position as they established themselves.
Okay,
here.
Now I'm going to, because you give me a lot of information. Mm-hmm. Were there, because in my, the national organization, if my understanding is correct, mm-hmm. it was a combination of the black women's mm-hmm. group and then mm-hmm. another group, and then so mm-hmm. they combined to come to the Urban League.
Yes.
Was that the same thing with the Detroit affiliate, or was it some a little bit distinctive?
Well, a little distinct. I think the Detroit Urban League just sort of started. The National Urban League, 6 years after the National Urban League was founded,
all
they
right.
started establishing affiliates around the country.
Right.
I think it's interesting, is in the NAACP, local entities are called chapters.
All right.
And they actually are more mandated to follow explicit what the National does. In the Urban League, we're called affiliates, and each of us are independent 501c3s. We're sort of akin to a franchise, like you were a fast food franchise
okay.
or something.
All right. All
so
right.
each of us have a basic mission that
right.
the National Urban League has, to enable right. African Americans and other people of color to reach their fullest potential. But every Urban League is a little different. Some
right.
do things that others don't do. Most of us are all involved in workforce activities. Most
right.
of us are all involved in, say, education, youth initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some Urban Leagues who are heavily involved in housing.
All right.
They build housing, they manufacture housing.
Mm-hmm.
In Detroit, we don't do that. But
right.
In past years, the Urban League has had housing counseling, for example. But each affiliate is a little bit different than the X. But we have a mandate to follow certain, what they call, terms of affiliation,
all right.
certain standards, certain
all right.
activities, and we pay dues to the National
All
League,
right.
So.
I had thought that maybe because each city may had, you know, little distinctive
mm-hmm.
challenges,
yes.
okay, and it had its own little flavor,
mm-hmm.
that might have been why there have been a differences, but you explained it much
yeah,
better.
Well, that's true. I mean, as the former Speaker of the House, now deceased Tip O'Neill, used to say, all politics are local. So depending on what's important in that community, you
mm-hmm.
know, that the Urban League does that. Sometimes it fills a void.
All right.
But in some communities, there's so much other stuff going on. There are a lot of different housing groups in Detroit area. So
right.
The Detroit Urban League itself does not have a separate housing unit, so to speak. We're not
right.
building houses.
Okay. Now, when I was also thinking about the different things, you brought up the fact that the NAACP and the Urban League are you collaborative organizations? You work, you know,
yeah.
Just how, what is the interaction between the
well,
two?
Well, you know, it was interesting when I was interviewed for this position some 30 years ago. I was working for the NAACP,
mm-hmm.
and the search committee asked me this question, you know, what is the difference between the NAACP and the Urban League? And
mm-hmm.
my simple answer was that the NAACP breaks down the door.
Okay.
The Urban League walks in. So, you know, but the NAACP is a much more advocacy-based organization.
Right.
They, you know, they file lawsuits. They fight to break the barriers.
Right.
So if NAACP is successful in creating employment opportunities, the Urban League can come in with its employment service staff and
mm-hmm.
resources
mm-hmm.
and work to get the community to get employment. So we are two separate organizations, but when we are doing what our missions call for us to
mm-hmm.
do, then the community really benefits from that work.
I know in my reading I saw one time they said that the Urban League is the State Department and the NAACP is the war room.
Well, that might be another description. They're breaking down the door and we're walking in. Yeah, that may be. But they're two different organizations. And oftentimes, because we're predominantly African-American organization in this community, the community sort of expects the same thing from us often,
mm-hmm.
and it's tough sometimes to let the community know that's not something we do.
All right.
We don't file lawsuits.
Okay.
That's something that ACP does.
All right.
So it's just kind of challenging, but you know, we do a variety of things. I would say that the Urban League sometimes is schizophrenic type organization, and that is has so many different things that it's expected to do or does.
All right. One of the other questions I had was that the NAACP is known to be multiracial or interracial. Mm-hmm. Is that the same thing with the Urban League?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. I think in the Urban League, one of the first things they ask us to do in the terms of affiliation mm-hmm. is to try to make sure we have a diverse board.
All right.
So we have people from all walks of life mm-hmm. on our board of directors. Currently, we try to make sure we have African-American, mm-hmm. white, Arab, Hispanic. Mm-hmm. Here in Detroit, we have one of the programs we'll talk about probably later is WIC, mm-hmm. but we have Arabic-speaking staff because mm-hmm. we have a large number of Arab population that we serve.
All right.
And we have Spanish-speaking staff because mm-hmm. we serve a large Hispanic population. So we're a mixed, varied organization, much more so than I say the NAACP is.
All right, my question, because I think a number of people tend to, when they say Urban League, they tend to think of it as the African-American organization. Mm-hmm. And you just described the fact that it's a multiracial. Does that, because it has that image, I guess, in the community, does that create problems for you? And if so,
well, it doesn't really create problems. I think in the beginning, it would have been easy to say that the Urban League served mostly African-Americans, population in the beginning. Right. But as time goes on, and I often tell people this from a variety of communities, that when people need help, mm-hmm. they need help.
All right.
And most of the times, you're not looking at the color of the people who are providing you food or mm-hmm. who are helping you find a job. Mm-hmm. You're thanking them for the service that they're providing.
All
so
right.
So it doesn't pose a big problem for us. I think from an image-wise, Ms. Daniel, I think it's important for us to figure out how to get the word across more clearly and more regularly so mm-hmm. people understand that we're a very diverse organization.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the Urban League, say, in Tucson, Arizona,
mm-hmm.
that probably serves more Hispanic population than they do African Americans because of where they're located.
Okay.
So in Detroit, there's a heavy African American population.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, we would probably serve a lot of African Americans. But we have a WIC clinic in Dearborn.
All right.
And we have mm-hmm. a WIC clinic in Southwest Detroit on West Verna, deep in Southwest Detroit. So,
all right.
So we are serving people from all walks of life. And when they walk through the door, from the history standpoint, there's no colored water fountain. That's one water fountain.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you get some challenges from the African-American community that maybe you are should not diversify and should stay?
Oh, absolutely not.
Okay.
No, I've never had that. I never in my years of working in the NAACP and in the Urban League, I've never mm-hmm. seen that. I mean, I started out as a youth member of the NAACP in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay.
And I got involved because of school issues mm-hmm. in North Carolina. Charlotte Mecklenburg school system used to bus us for the purpose of segregation.
Mm-hmm.
And when the courts ruled in 1970-71 that Charlotte Mecklenburg was discriminating and segregating the schools,
mm-hmm.
when they integrated the Charlotte Mecklenburg schools, we had too many school buses. You know, up north, the cry was busing was bad. But in the south, mm-hmm. busing was okay if it was used to segregate.
Okay.
So Charlotte Mecklenburg had a surplus of buses when they were forced to integrate schools.
All right.
So, but I got involved in the NAACP as a high school student. And throughout my career in NAACP and the Urban League, I've always seen a mixed population of people who care and mm-hmm. who are involved.
All right. Now, and I was, in the different, I know you're talking about 106 years, is that correct?
For the National Urban League, it's 106 years. So okay. Detroit Urban League is 101 years now.
All right. Okay. Mm-hmm. And when they started out, they had certain challenges because there's a move, the Black Migration, as it was termed. And then what they met when they came to the northern cities.
Mm-hmm.
Then as it evolved, then you had to break the trade unions, then they had to the armed forces. Mm-hmm. Those are all the different challenges. It's like your roots are that's a foundation. Mm-hmm. All right. Based on what the organization started out with, how does that impact what you're dealing with today?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting as we look at the history of the Urban League. as I said earlier, there have been 8 presidents in 101 years of the Detroit Urban League.
Right.
And I count twice. But
okay.
One of the persons who served Urban League the longest, John Dancy. Mr. Dancy joined the Urban League in 1918 and retired in 1960, 42 years later.
All right.
But when I read John Dancy's biography, he talked about the work that he did at the Urban League then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Urban League had baby clinics.
All right.
The Urban League did house calls, social work, house calls, door-to-door. The Urban League, you know, back then they called it vocational services, then it became employment services, and today it's called workforce, but it was the same thing.
Right.
The Urban League had the Pen and Palette Club. It was working with young students and teaching them and helping them with their writing and their development. And so it's kind of ironic that when you think about what the Urban League started doing, that in 1916 and during his tenure, those 42 years, today we don't have a baby clinic per se. We have WIC clinics. So we're still serving infant women and children in our WIC clinics.
All right.
And then we don't call it vocational services, but we call it workforce. It is still helping people with their career choices, their resume writing, their job search. We don't have the Pen and Palette Club per se, but we have something called the College Club and STEM programming. And we're working with young people from 8th through 12th grade, getting them to think about college, prepare them for college. And I mean, last year we looked at 6 of the students in our College Club and realized that they had all achieved collectively over $1 million in scholarships.
All right.
So, you know, we have not, we've changed how we approach it, but we still serve the same population. We're still have the same issues and the same needs. So it has not, you know, our work has not really changed significantly.
Mm-hmm.
We just do things differently.
All right. Now, and this is not to be a blindside question, but it's a question that I just kind of get you alert. That when I was reading it, it was said that the NAACP, and the part of the implication or the suggestion was that the NAACP dealt with more of the affluent class.
No, the Urban League did. I think the Urban League would claim to be more affluent than the NAACP.
Okay, all right. And so there was this divide, I guess, between the, not necessarily the have-nots, but the ones who were migrant and those who recognized as their, what was it called? I can't remember them. There was another movement. But do you still see that kind of a thing going on?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because, again, having worked for both organizations, I would say I worked at the Detroit branch in NAACP as the youth director, and I worked at the national staff of the NAACP as the director of the Midwest region, the 7 states of the NAACP.
Okay.
And then, as I said earlier, I was in high school and into college, I was an active youth council member of the NAACP. But in the NAACP, most of its members and presidents of youth of college campuses or adult chapters are all volunteers.
All right.
You cannot have an Urban League affiliate without a paid staff. That's a mandate, and that's a requirement.
All right.
So in some respects, in some communities, there could be tensions because the Urban League is paying its staff, and the NAACP volunteers are working their regular jobs during the day and at night, and they're having to volunteer for their services.
Mm-hmm.
So in Detroit, Reverend Anthony is the president of the NAACP, but he doesn't get paid.
Okay.
You know, maybe get some expenses for travel related to that, but me, I'm the president of the Urban League, and it's a job. That could be that kind of thinking and that thought. But yeah, the Urban League, throughout the years, there have been things that suggested we were the Suburban League or the Bourbon League, not the Urban League. But the fact of the matter is, we serve the low income and the disadvantaged and those who are in need, we don't focus on, we try not to focus on that because there could be times, and I think it was much more issue many, many years ago where people thought that the Urban League was not for the average person.
All right.
When I read John Dancy's book about his 42 years and Dr. Francis Albert Cornegay in the 38 years he worked at the Urban League, 18 of those as president of the Urban League, the things that they tried to do during their time, because as people came from the north, from the south to the north, there were people who lived in Detroit, had been born in Detroit, who were, you know, ticked off and bothered by some of these, what they were called, country bumpkins that came to Detroit. And it was interesting because the Urban League had published published pamphlets and things back in the 20s and 30s about how to act when you're on the bus. You know, not to wear rollers in your hair when you're on the bus. Don't barbecue in the front yard. I mean, those this kind of thing that they were saying that people from the South needed to be socialized or do things a little differently than
to
what they were doing.
Acculturated
them. So it was those back in those days, there were those kind of things. So somebody might have said, wait a minute, who are you to tell me how to dress in public and how to present myself? But we still do it today because we're telling young people when you're looking for a job, you can't just go to the place looking any kind of a way. You know, there are a lot of casualness in some workplaces, but you have to pay attention to how that workplace functions and operates.
Okay.
And so you still talk about that. You tell people in technology, you tell young people and older people alike, when you more and more jobs are by electronic application, you have to have an email address, that you need a professional sounding email address. You know, you don't need to say
sugar daddy,
fine hammer. You know, you need an email address that speaks more formally versus informally. You might have a different, you know, Miss Fine or Miss Sexy or Miss Heavenly Body or something like that. You need to have the right kind of. So we're still trying to educate and inform people that you want to make the right impression the first time, and you want to do things appropriately and correctly. So,
all right. Do you Is there a, because I guess we were looking at some of my other reading, and my mind is kind of jumping around, so bear with me. I remember reading that during the part of your history where you were combating trade unions and trying to get into trade unions, that type of thing. Are those kind of, and those are economic as opposed to social, and although, you know, it's like, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg, that type of thing.
I think the chicken.
All right. In that addressing, you know, the, you know, how to dress, you know, dress for success. Okay, that's the phrase we have now. Do you sometimes get, or do you feel that maybe there's too much focus on the dress and not then what you're supposed to succeed at, you know, like the trade unions?
Well, there's a challenge here because I think, you know, in the trade union, I think that's an issue today is how do we get more young men and women into the trades and into the trade unions where the pay is good, you know, and you still see that as a problem because as you work with students, say, in some school districts, they are not doing well at math and science. And it's kind of hard to get into the trades of the electrician or plumbing or the other skilled trades that you have in the construction business and somebody in the plants unless you can pass a certain level of test. You know, to read at a certain grade point level or math at a certain level. So that's still a challenge. And I would imagine back in the day for the Urban League, it was trying to make sure that they did not discriminate against qualified people who were trying to apply for those jobs. You know, what we know is that in the 20s, 30s, 40s, well-skilled, well-qualified, well-educated African-Americans could not get a job.
Right.
And they ended up working at the post office, which is a reasonable place to work. I'm not saying it's not. But you would have a person who would have a master's degree working as a bank teller versus a bank manager because of discrimination.
Okay.
You know, we read Damon Keith's book in his life, and he's working as a janitor while he's in law school.
All right.
And as he talks about being in the bathroom at the Detroit News on his break, reading his law book, and white reporter comes by and, you know, denigrates him because, boy, you can't be a lawyer. You know, look at him today. So we know that back in the day there were a lot of African Americans who had the skill sets, had the ability, had the training, and because of racism and discrimination could not get the job.
Okay.
Today, there's still racism and discrimination, and but there are people who are very well trained But on the other hand, we need to make sure, and that's part of what our college club is all about, how do we get young people prepared and to start thinking about their education and their careers down the road? Let's get this map in all the eighth grade, in the ninth grade, 12th mm-hmm. grade. Let's make sure you can read at a higher than sixth grade level.
All right.
Because colleges are having one heck of a time, and you would probably know this better than me, with having to go through remediation
right.
with young people when they come to school. You right. know, they come in and they're not ready
right.
for college level work. They have right. to go back and catch up, and that's expensive and time consuming.
All right. Do you think that possibly there's another divide, you know, the digital divide. We have that going on now. Mm-hmm. Is that adding to what we just talked about, that where people are not really savvy with the, you know, the email address, you know, how do you, now get, so the written resume is becoming mm-hmm. a thing of the past, right. You know, on mm-hmm. the visual resume. Are these some of the things, and is there a thing where the Urban League was going back to its original foundation, where they're feeling the challenges are just coming now, but in a global type of situation?
Well, I think young people in general are very well technologically savvy. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I have the grandkids who pick up a little electronic game, and I can't play the electronic game, but they're mastering it, you know.
Right,
so,
right.
But you know, what we find a lot of times, one of the programs we operate, for example, is called the Seniors Urban Jobs Program. Mm-hmm. We work with people 55 and over, mm-hmm. helping them get back on track and back into the job market. Mm-hmm. And so we find that in that age group, some of them are still a little reluctant and not as savvy with technology and mm-hmm. computers, for example, as they should be. We mm-hmm. have a computer lab in one of our buildings, and we try to work with mature people to make sure they understand mm-hmm. how to turn on the computer, how to use it, you know, how is your friend, not your enemy. But at the same time, I went in the lab one day this week and turned on one of the computers in the lab, logged on to the internet, Yahoo, and someone else's email opened. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to the staff, we need to keep working with the mature workers, the mm-hmm. people, to make them understand that you need to close out their right. email account when right. they finish. They need right. to say close, mm-hmm. log out.
Right.
Because if they don't log out, anyone can walk in and go into their inbox. If there's some personal confidential mm-hmm. information, it could be stolen. But mm-hmm. I'm on one computer, and I was in two different email accounts with people who had used the computer prior to me.
Right.
So we find ourselves trying to help people who are more mature become more sophisticated and capable of using the computer. My mother's 80-some mm-hmm. years old, so she's not using the computer. But my wife's father, or pseudo-father, is 90-some years old, and mm-hmm. he loves his tablet. So you know, you try to explain mm-hmm. that to older people.
Okay.
Younger people, you just want them to use it responsibly.
Okay.
That's been the challenge, like I said earlier, whether they're using the right email address, or whether they're putting stuff on Facebook, Instagram,
okay.
that will live in infamy, that will okay. come back to haunt them somewhere down the road. Because more and more employers are doing internet searches for people who apply for jobs. So you can just get a sense of who is this individual. You know, is N. Charles Anderson someone who parties all the time, and he has pictures on the internet of him drinking beer and being drunk and acting a fool, or is he a civil, decent, reasonable individual? So you want to make sure that you're helping young people understand that this technology should be used more responsibly. You need to be careful about what you put out there. So, you know, in our college club meetings with our students, we've had people come in and talk to them about the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also had people come in and talk to them about human trafficking, because the internet is, you know, people troll the internet for a lot of things and take advantage of a lot of people, particularly young people.
All right.
And so we're trying to help them understand that this can happen to you. You know, most of us think that's someone else that's happening to. It can't happen to me until it happens to me.
Right, right. I hear you talking about the young adults and stuff. Is the Urban League still community oriented, or is it just, you know, youth, or just, you know,
In the Detroit Urban League, I think the answer is, you know, simple answer is yes.
Okay.
But in the Detroit Urban League, we talk about the fact that we have services, and we are serving about 13,000+ people a month. Their number's real, 13,000 plus a month.
Okay, now we're talking just young adults or
all? Oh, everybody.
All right.
But we serve people from conception, and, you know, before they're born, and the mothers and their pregnant moms, and until they're well up in age in our mature workers program.
Okay.
And so we're serving people from every age group in our program and in our activities. We're not singly focused on youth, nor singly focused on babies, or singly focused on adults, but we're focused on them all.
Okay. Then am I hearing more that there's a social focus as opposed to an economic or an
I think it's economic. I think for the older worker or younger persons alike who you're trying to get back into the job market or into the job market, that's their economic development. That's helping them have a comfortable life and living.
Okay.
But, you know, it's important because I think, you know, on the other hand, our programs contribute to the economy. Our seniors employment program is a $1.5 million annual payroll.
All right.
That money goes back into the economy here in Oakland and Wayne counties.
All right.
And these individuals have money in their pockets that can help get them to another level.
Okay.
Our WIC program actually provides over $10 million annually in benefits to the women and children and families that take advantage of that program. So that's an economy stimulator in itself. The Urban League as an organization with its $5 million budget, you know, we contribute to the economy with our payroll because we have people, including what they pay me. I used to say I get paid. I get paid weekly, weekly. But even when it comes to vendors, we make it a point to try to the best of our ability to use local small business people for plumbing and our furnace go out, our painting, you know, just the things we need. So we contribute a significant amount to the economy.
Okay.
I think one of the things that challenges me and bothers me sometimes is that the public does not really understand that what it takes to run a nonprofit is fundamentally the same thing it takes to run General Motors.
All right.
There's nothing in the law that says a nonprofit is exempt from the EEOC laws.
All right.
We have to follow the law too. We can be sued for discrimination. We have to, depending on the size, we have to comply with FMLA, the Family Medical Leave Act.
All right.
When we process our payroll, we have to send that money 3 days later to the federal government.
Okay.
You know, so we have to do everything. You know, I always tell folk that health care is as big a challenge for me as it is for General Motors. The only difference is there are more zeros on their check when they pay for health care. But the fundamental concerns of health care are the same for me at the Urban League as it would be for Mary Barra and her staff at General Motors. You know, how do you afford it? How do you make sure it's reasonable?
All right. And then that's something else that I remember, you know, some part of your history, that in the 1963, when they were preparing that March on Washington, one of the issues was that the Urban League was very supportive in helping and working with the NAACP, or a lot of combination of organizations at that time.
It was SCLC.
And that was a moral stand, if you will, that was made by your president to continue to work with those organizations. Do you still find, are there still times now where there's that moral stand that kind of, you know, puts you in?
Well, you know, most of the, and you think about, we're talking about the marches that are held nationally. There's a national group called the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, and all of the major civil rights type organizations, whether it's La Raza, SCLC, the Urban League, the NAACP, the National Action Network, Reverend Sharpton, they all form one big group, and they all generally work together to focus on national issues. To try to, you know, there can be strength in numbers, and if you can, have coalitions that are working on the same initiative and the same action, that, that there's a better chance of success, perhaps. But it's challenging because, you know, in Detroit, sometimes I say, well, why are they starting another organization when there are so many organizations fighting to survive? You know, the Urban League provides a variety of services, but someone creates a new organization to work with youth, and now they're busy trying to raise money. They're busy trying to find a place to operate from, and as a result, there are plenty of people who are in need. But sometimes we need to do a better job of collaborating. You know, we still need to do a better job of collaborating or working together to make sure that we're doing the best we can to serve the public and the community. You know, we became, there used to be an Urban League in Pontiac. And we became the Urban League of Southeastern Michigan because we wanted to incorporate Pontiac and Oakland County when that Urban League went out of business. You know, we talked to them before they went out of business about our collaborating and working together, that we're in the same geographic market, the same media market, et cetera. So, but we didn't get where we wanted to get to in terms of creating that work together. And so when they folded and went out of business, so, you know, a few years later, we just changed our name. And now the program that we run for seniors, for example, have put them to work. We have a large, we have 100 slots that are based in Oakland County. And we're working with a large number of low-income people up around Pontiac and other parts of the county that would not have normally had this service had it not been for our opportunity to expand ourselves.
Okay. I also noticed that, again, with my research, there was one of your executive officers. You just recently started becoming president, but before you were called directors, I can't remember your...
You know, years ago... an Urban League CEO would have been called executive secretary, executive director, and before I began, I think over the years, Whitney Young was the national president of the National Urban League, and then Vernon Jordan was the national president. I'm thinking that during the Vernon Jordan years, that became an initiative among Urban League execs, I'm told, to change the title so that we would be more in line with the corporate level staff and titles that we have. So we're known, we wouldn't be executive secretaries. If you were advertised for executive secretary, someone who was a clerk typist would apply for the job. You know, so you say you want a president and CEO. And it, it really speaks to the point I was making earlier about trying to demonstrate that running the, an organization, whether it's the Urban League or the Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts or Big Brothers, Big Sisters, there are administrative responsibilities. Responsibilities that we have, and titles sometimes, you know, there may be something in the title that will help clarify and make clear that at the Urban League we have an accountant who's doing accounting. You know, we have finance people because our funding sources want us to spend their money appropriately and spend it wisely.
All right. A number of questions. All right. The first question, and I don't want to get back to that funding source, but the question I was really starting to pick up on was one of your national organizational presidents began to look at tightening the structure of the Urban League just based on certain things you just said, you know, the Pontiac decided to fold, that type of thing. As I'm looking at now where the middle class may be a yesterday's news, it does no longer exist. Are you still, is that another issue that where you're having to reinvent the wheel or reinvent the Urban League.
I'm not sure if I'm following you clearly, but one of the things that we are doing is in terms of ourselves being affiliates is that it's critically important that there's some standardization around the country of how an Urban League functions and operates. And today with technology is even more important because if a company based in Portland, Oregon, has some franchises around the country, or a company based in Seattle like Starbucks. If the Seattle Urban League blows up, you know, in a bad way, would that impact, with Starbucks being headquartered there, would that impact how Starbucks react to Urban League in Detroit? You think we're the same, or are we different? You know, And so we do the Urban League, and within the Urban League, to me, it's important that all of my colleagues around the country have a effective, efficient, and appropriate way of functioning and raising dollars, not misappropriating funds,
right.
Paying his taxes, and not having problems that could spill over into Detroit by default.
Right.
You know, so if a Bank of America is in Charlotte, North Carolina, and something in North Carolina goes sour with the Urban League, will the Bank of America people in Detroit be told to not give that Urban League any money because the Urban League has gone bad? So it is important that we all have a certain quality and approach to how we do work.
All right.
It's important.
Okay. Another historical thing was when based on, and it's kind of like a dovetailing that franchise aspect of it, was when the NAACP and Sharpton had a district, no, they had different positions, okay? Two different things going on. On one hand, standardization is good, but on the other hand, sometimes standardization closes down.
Yeah, well, you know, we're not a monolith. We're not, we're not walking lockstep. You know, the reality is, as an affiliate of the National Urban League, I'm not necessarily mandated to take a position that the National Urban League takes.
Okay. You know,
so in fact, I would think back, Clarence Thomas was nominated for Supreme Court.
All right.
The National Urban League under John Jacob didn't take a position one way or the other.
Okay.
And the Detroit Urban League voted that we were not going to support it, but we also said we were not going to oppose it.
You know?
And so we just put our statement out. The next thing I know, the LA Times, the New York Times, and Newsweek and everyone was calling us because we sort of upstaged the National Urban League, but we didn't violate any contents of policy because we're not necessarily obligated. I think as the president and CEO of the Detroit Urban League, an affiliate, my goal, and I think the board's goal, is to try to be as supportive of what positions the National Urban League takes as we can be. You know, the National Urban League been opposed to certain appointments that the president has made. We didn't like those appointments either locally. But some Urban Leagues may not have felt like they could get in that game, you know.
Okay.
I don't, you know, but I think you have to, sometimes it's important that you have a conscience and an ethic about what you stand for, what you do, and you do have to sometimes go against your friends.
All right.
If their friends are doing something that's not appropriate.
All right.
Yeah, I had a minister, I heard him, he used to say that if I'm your friend, I'm going to be with you when you're right to keep you right.
Okay.
But if you're wrong, I'm gonna be there as your friend to help get you right.
Okay.
And so, you know, you can't. I look at some of the people who support certain politicians and positions that they take, and you gotta call it when you see it.
All right.
You know, if the guy is lying, if he's wrong, his friends have got to say, "Look, man, I can't support that craziness. You got to get your act together." And so, it was Barbara Jordan or someone, you say, "I'm unbought and unbossed." So you got to stay unbought and unbossed.
Okay. All right. Now, there used to be a publication opportunity that was part of the Urban League. Do you have a new publication? Or
no, the Urban League doesn't have that opportunity. The magazine just come out on a regular basis. A lot of magazines are folded. Now, those who are making money and those who are not.
Right.
In an electronic way, the National Urban League sends out a something on a weekly basis, an electronic publication, a position that goes to people who support the Urban League. The Urban League still publishes annually the State of Black America report.
Okay.
And so as of last year, they stopped printing the book and made it a web-based. So you can, it's free. Used to publish the book and sell it. They made, Mark Mariel made a decision in the National Urban League a year ago to say, you know, based on the amount of effort and resources that we get from selling this book, we may as well give it away.
Okay.
So, but it's still a very popular publication that people like to get. And so when it comes out, and it'll come out in May of this year, the State of Black America Report for 2017, it'll be accessible online.
Okay.
And folk can get it.
What is the state of Black America?
Well, you know, there's still the challenges of unemployment. You know, that while the nation might say the unemployment rate is 6%, in the African American community, it still may be 12 to 20%.
All right.
And in minority youth, it may be even greater than that.
Okay.
So there are still the challenges, the income, the differences in the wealth or net worth of African American versus non-African Americans is still a challenge.
All right.
We still hear the talk that women are paid 58 cents on the dollar compared to what men are paid.
All right.
But in the African American community, it's still less, you know, we're less well off than the rest of the population.
Okay. The state of the Black community locally.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the same or is it different, more distinctive?
Well, you know, Detroit, you know, that is the challenge, I think, Ms. Daniels, in that when we look at a city like Detroit where there's revitalization, building, and construction, and people are moving in downtown and restaurants are opening, gentrification is still real.
Mm-hmm.
Homelessness is still a big issue in Detroit. And unemployment,
yes,
and low underemployment and housing is still a concern. Because if you look in Midtown Detroit, where the Urban League's headquarters building is, all around us, that the used to be people who lived on Cass and these low-income housing.
They used to be black.
You know, but all of a sudden,
it's Midtown.
That's Midtown. And they can't afford to stay there anymore.
Right.
They're being pushed out.
Right.
So gentrification is real. So I think it's incumbent upon organizations like the Urban League to keep out front the realities of what's happening in the community, because we can all get this feel-good flavor with us that Dan Gilbert is doing this and the Illiches are doing that. May Mr. Illich rest in peace. But at the same time, you emanate out toward the rest of the city where I live.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you still have people who are struggling to have a place to live, to get a loan on their house, to renovate their house, to have a job that they can pay for the house, to not have enough money to pay their taxes so the house doesn't go in foreclosure,
mm-hmm,
and they become homeless. I mean, that's a reality. I mean, I think even in Midtown Detroit, you know, the some of the apartments sold, people have been living there for years, paying $500 a month.
Right.
They sell the building, force those people out, do some renovation, and now they're renting the places for $2,500 a month.
I know.
Yeah.
And, you know, it used to be kind of telling on myself and dating myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I was in college at Wayne State, you know, that Midtown was, you know, the Cass Corridor.
Yes, exactly.
All right. And you know, you go down Cass Corridor to see a freak show.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
And now those same places, you know, is a totally different environment.
Yeah, it's the you know you dress up to go there now. You used to dress down to go there. Yeah.
Yes, right. Yeah. So it's a totally different type of thing. You have Detroit, Dearborn, Hamtramck,
mm-hmm,
Highland Park, Ferndale.
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of the north, the southeast?
Oh, yes, okay. Absolutely.
Okay.
Southeastern Michigan incorporates all of that. Like I said earlier, we have 9 women, infant, and children clinics around southeastern Michigan. We have one that's in Oak Park. One is in Dearborn,
mm-hmm,
at the Outer Drive and Michigan Avenue. One down in southwest Detroit on West Verner.
Okay.
And then we have a WIC clinic over on the east side inside of the St. John Medical Building. So we're spread out.
Okay. Does the Urban League interact with organizations that have a similar function? I'm thinking of Access. Those different do you think Access is comparable to you? Or?
Well, you know, Access has a heavy focus on the Arab community,
mm-hmm,
much more than we do.
Mm-hmm.
Our focus is skewed toward African American community. So mm-hmm, we know each other.
Aren't the challenges challenges the same?
We have similar challenges, but I think what Access does, particularly in helping acclimate and bring people from the Middle East and get them situated in this community, is important to what they can do. Because I'm not an expert. We're not experts, mm-hmm, on that. as I said, though, we do have Arab clients, mm-hmm. Chaldean clients, mm-hmm. in particularly in our WIC program. Mm-hmm. So we do make a point to hire mm-hmm. Arab-speaking staff mm-hmm. so that we can better serve that community. Mm-hmm. But in that regard, we serve each other's community, that each of us serves similar people in our mm-hmm. community, but they're probably a better source for the Arab community because mm-hmm. that's what they were organized to
do. It's almost like Access is the Urban League of today.
Well, of the
for that community.
For the Caribbean community.
Detroit, United States mm-hmm. has an influx of different immigrations, okay? And the uniqueness about the Black is that we were brought here, but then we kind of became a different immigrant, mm-hmm. okay? That mm-hmm. type of thing. And I'm looking at that, you know, the histories or the developments are meeting the same challenges, mm-hmm. the same mm-hmm. type of thing. Mm-hmm. I come back to the question now of, you know, you say gentrification. And gentrification is not necessarily middle class. That's mm-hmm. a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Does that bring unique challenges to organizations such as the Urban League?
Well, I think there are people who were once middle class who now need our service, for mm-hmm. example. mm-hmm. If that's getting to the gist of your question. Mm-hmm. And I see that particularly in our seniors employment program because mm-hmm. there were 25 years ago, the seniors program, the average participant would have been a high school dropout or barely high school graduate. Mm-hmm. Today, a significant number of our senior program participants are people with college degrees, mm-hmm. former school teachers, mm-hmm. lawyer, mm-hmm. an engineer, mm-hmm. you know, people who had management roles and mm-hmm. their companies changed, mm-hmm. downsized, mm-hmm. Technology eliminated their job.
Right.
So, you know, banks don't need as many tellers and bankers as they used to because if you're like me, you know, you go to the ATM or you go online and pay your bills.
Right.
And, you know, sit around. Like, I used to sit down on Sunday nights and spend 2 hours writing checks, paying bills.
Right.
I mean, I don't do that anymore, you know, with technology. Or I point out to people, you go park your car, and those entry-level jobs that people used to have at a parking lot don't exist anymore.
Right.
So in that regard, the middle class have to retool themselves to be more employable.
All right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Metro Wayne County, which is manufacturing mm-hmm. based. Okay. Mm-hmm. New challenges for Urban League types of things.
I think because the work that these automobile plants or manufacturing plants have today is not as much hands-on as it used to be. You know, it's been many years, but I went to a tour of the monster plant up in Flat Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And what was amazing to me in my walkthrough of that plant was that there were hardly any employees at some stages of that plant because technology was doing everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you didn't really see people working on the car
right.
until it was coming off the assembly line.
Right, right.
So those jobs where you had low skills and high pay, those are gone.
Right.
Now you need high skills
right.
for high pay.
Right.
That's a challenge for a lot of employers is to find the
is
right
people. Is that a challenge also for the Urban League?
Well, I think it's a challenge because a lot of companies come to us saying we need help finding people from the African-American community to apply for these engineering roles or
right.
these high-level tech jobs.
Right.
And then trying to find those people becomes a challenge sometimes.
Mm-hmm. So
that's why I said earlier that we work with particularly in our young adult and our college club students to get them more acclimated to what the jobs in the future are going to require
mm-hmm.
and to get them to start thinking about it.
I
used to go to career days a lot, you know, ask the young people what they want to do when they grow up. And inevitably, a lot of young men want to be football and basketball players. And young ladies would be saying they want to be doctors and lawyers. And then I would ask the students, what were three things that no matter what you did, you need to be able to do?
Okay.
And some would guess around, but my position was that you need to be able to read, you need to be able to write, and you need to know arithmetic or math.
All right.
If you had a good core foundation, you could, you know, any job you take, Because if you were a basketball player making millions, who's going to help manage your money?
All right.
You know, and that point, you know, a guy like Tommy Hearns made a lot of money boxing, but so did Emmanuel Stewart managing him.
Okay.
And I tell the students, Emmanuel Stewart never got hit upside the head like Tommy did. You know, so but he made as much money.
All right.
Made a lot of money. Right. So there's money to be made in every aspect of life.
All right.
You know, this young lady is going to be a lawyer. You're going to go out and play basketball, but the young lady could be your lawyer and get 10% of your money.
Yes.
Just by virtue of helping manage you through the contract process.
Do you see a lot of this going to the extremes? Because for a while there, there was a thrust to get, I remember when I was in college, and maybe not so done again, when I was in high school, and I'm dating myself again, there was a curriculum called college prep, and there was mm-hmm. also the curriculum called vocation, mm-hmm. you know, so the, mm-hmm. you had then they were kind of mm-hmm. side by side, mm-hmm. and at times the college prep sometimes looked down on the folks who were trade, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. type of thing, but now, you know, trade, the whole face of trade has changed.
Yeah.
Okay, like you're saying, you need to be trigonometry, you need mm-hmm. all these kinds of things mm-hmm. to be in the trades.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something, you know, making people aware, the community aware, and teaching, you know, bringing that thing?
Yeah, I think it's a challenge. I mean, you talk to young people about all of these things because you want folk to understand that there's money to be made in a variety of ways. You know, go to the TV station, and while there may be limited roles on camera, there's money to be made behind the camera. And you try to educate young people to all the opportunities. So, you know, the things that you do, taking them on field trips, have people come in and talk to them, kind of stimulate them to start thinking about the options that are at their disposal. A lot of times what we found is that young people just need to be exposed to their opportunities. You know, mm-hmm. as my own self growing up, I think about how much further I could have been had I been exposed to more when I was growing up in Charlotte, North Carolina.
All right.
And, you know, the phenomenal today about a lot of people going to see the movie Hidden Figures.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of, you know, we said, well, why do we know about these women before now?
Okay.
But when I sat and watched that movie, a really great movie, you know, I thought to myself, how much faster could America have gotten into space if there hadn't have been racist and discriminatory against people who were capable and skilled?
All right.
You know, John Glenn knew that his life depended on that woman being able to give him the right reading. He trusted no one else.
Okay.
And you said, well, how much farther could we have gotten if it had not been for that? Or how much more could that young man, young lady have been able to do had they just simply been exposed to what's out there?
All right. So...
exposing young people is one of the things that I encourage people to do. And you don't have to be at the Urban League to expose young people. You can do it in your family life. You can do it to young people at your church. You can mm-hmm. do it just in your next door neighbors. You can take your nephew, niece, and other grandkids. You can expose people mm-hmm. to things.
Okay.
No one took me to any basketball games when I was growing up.
All right.
But I take my grandkids to the basketball game so they can see what's going on in this environment.
All right.
You know, there are a lot of things going on that we don't know about until we've been exposed to it.
All right. Coming to a close, what do you see the three major challenges for the Urban League in the next 10 to 15 years?
Well, I think our challenge still is having one of the big challenges for us is being able to have the resources to do the basic things that need to be done.
Okay.
You know, the cover, the you know, if we could raise money to do employment, what we still need our funds to make sure that our facilities are in order and that our administrative operations are there, because no one's going to give us funding if we can't have a clean audit mm-hmm. and we have to be audited annually mm-hmm. based on our size. And so that's a challenge for us. The next challenge, I think, is being able to attract quality staff, people who mm-hmm. are interested in serving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a time when a lot of people wanted to be social workers,
mm-hmm.
and the Urban League only functioned with social workers.
Right.
Today, we have people of all walks of life, so I think that's a challenge. And mm-hmm. then that is continuing to stimulate, educate, and prepare young people for the opportunities that are in front of us.
Okay. What in looking?
So that those are the challenges. And I think what I think about what I've been able to do while I've been in Durban League, we've obtained a couple of new properties. We have a building on the west side that mm-hmm. we did not have before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm proud to say that we created the College Club.
Okay.
Because looking in 88, looking at the service that we're providing, there are a lot of programs that focus on young children or people who are in trouble, who have problems.
All right.
You know, 95% of our children are good kids.
All right.
And so we created the College Club to reinforce positive youth development.
Okay.
You know, we saw, we were working with children who were in trouble, and we saw, we were taking them on special field trips, exposing them, but we saw good children acting out so they could get in the group that was getting free pizza. So I said, well, why should we penalize them for being good?
Okay.
So I'm glad that we started the College Club so we could focus on part of youth development. I think back on one of my favorite groups, the Whispers,
mm-hmm.
and Nicholas Caldwell, who passed away last year, wrote the song about another day has come and gone in a world where I don't belong.
Okay.
But his tagline was, but it seems like I gotta do wrong before they notice me.
Okay.
You know, so we don't want kids to do wrong to get attention.
Right.
We should recognize and reward them for the positive things they do. So every year, for example, in December, we have what we call our Gil Gala.
Okay.
And during our Gil Gala, we ask the community to nominate young people
mm-hmm.
for our Do the Right Thing Award.
All right.
So we have over 100, 200 young people who come to that luncheon. And we recognize and celebrate them for doing the right thing, the
right.
positive things that they do.
Okay.
So we're proud of that kind of work that we do because we do want to stop the young men and women from becoming troublemakers and criminals.
Right.
But we also want to stop the young men and women who aren't headed in that direction and keep them on the right, straight, and narrow path. So we celebrate young people who do the right thing, and that's something we're glad about.
And on that, I think I'm going to move close. And
thank you
very much, Mr. Anderson, for being a part of Impact.
This
is Betty Daniels thanking you for attending Impact and being a part of the Black History Moment.
And you're listening to WHFI Dearborn. Guys and dolls out there, you're at the Monk Shop with Daddy G here in WHFR. And so we're going back to the 50s and 60s today, within the next 2 hours anyway. and then my buddy's coming up to play some more 50s and 60s. So anyways, grab your favorite squeeze, hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, and head on down to the Monk Shop, where the jukebox is playing, the kids are dancing. And here we are, back in the 50s.